Hello, I'm Jack.
And I'm Martin.
And we are The Washboard Resonators. Welcome to our podcast, The Washboard Resonators Present. Conversations from behind the red curtain on vintage music and stories from the entertainment industry. Hello and welcome back to another week of The Washboard Resonators Presents. This week is the second part of our conversation with Michael Messer. So if you haven't heard that, please go back and listen to our conversation about him going from a hairdresser to one of the world's best blues guitarists and resonator maker.
So in 1988, Diving Duck had come out. And it was doing really well. It was picking up a lot of radio, selling well. I was touring, and my record company called me and said, you know, how would you like to work with Ted Hawkins? Ted Hawkins, I've seen him on the TV, you know. Amazing. Ted Hawkins was a big artist at the time, and he was doing sort of 1,000, 2,000 seat venues, very much the college circuit, solo artist, and he was very, very hip at the time. And basically what my record company had said to me was, would you like to produce an album, Ted?
Wow.
Would I ever? Yeah.
He's an American artist now. It's Ted Hawkins, right?
Ted Hawkins is an American artist, African-American. He was known as the Busker from Venice Beach. Ian Anderson and Andy Kershaw discovered him and brought him to the UK. And he, you know, got him on the whistle test, and he became a big artist on the alternative college scene, you know.
And is that where
a Leeds label, Dave Foster, you know Dave Foster?
Yeah.
Dave Foster, Un-American Activities signed him, and they did half a dozen albums or so, you know, that were very successful records. And to cut a long story short, my band and Ted moved into Rack Studios, Mickey Most Studios. And we made an album there.
Had he heard of you then? How did it come that, or was it record companies putting it together?
It was record companies putting this together.
And just to be clear, you produced?
Yeah, I hadn't produced before. I'd produced my own, but I wanted to get into production.
Interesting.
And it was a co-production, but I would call it a production, really.
But you were thrown at the deep end here, really. So just in itself, that must have been an amazing experience and an amazing learning curve in Mickey Mouse Studio with this amazing artist producing for the first time. What was that like?
It was an amazing experience, and I picked up very. You know, I was working there with, The Cure were in one studio, and
wow.
the Pogues were in another.
We'd all
meet up. You know, the Pogues were doing the album with the boxer on the front.
Yeah.
What's his name? The Cure. What's his name? Lovely guy.
Robert Smith.
Lovely guy. Really nice.
Yeah, really
guy.
Nice girl.
And I got to know Shane quite well through that period, and yeah, it was a lovely time. And we'd all meet up in the rest room, and you know, talk rubbish
amazing.
To each other and. Talk rubbish and do what you do, and it was a great time. Yeah.
Wow. So how did the record come out then? Like, how did it start? Like,
the record was a full band project rather than a solo project, and it was a sort of a warm sounding soul record, sort of in the kind of almost like a modern twist on the sort of thing Sam Cooke would have done. It was released. It was originally released as "I Love You Too."
Yeah.
And that was on PT Records.
Yeah.
And then PT Records went bust, basically. They folded, which was a sad story, but it's what happened. And the record lay dormant for a long time. While I was working with Ted, when I went to meet Ted in 88, in December 88, was at the Mean Fiddler acoustic room in London. He was doing a one-off gig before he flew back to America for Christmas. And I took my Sony professional Walkman along because I wanted to capture what Ted was doing. and just away, you know, plugged it into the desk. There's two quite amazing stories about that. One is that that recording became this album on Catfish Records that was released in around 2001, 2002. Was my recording I made on my cassette recorder at the Mean
Field. Wow, your actual recording.
I've listened to that. That was your flipping mini, not mini,
Walkman. Yeah, I recorded it. I recorded it off the desk. On
it's a great recorder. Sounding record.
It's a great record.
It's almost like a bootleg, but it's good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
we
were going to clean it up. And when we decided to release it, and I had this, you know, had this tape, we sat, you know, in the mastering studio we were using for a while and cleaned up a couple of tracks. And I said, you know what? Sounds horrible. You know what sounds much better, don't you? Let's just be honest and say what it is, and let's just put it out as the cassette. And let's not clean it up. And it sounds better. It sounds more pure.
So was this a few years after when you recorded with him? Because it sounds like you're more...
No, this is the same. This is before I recorded with him.
Oh, I see. Okay, so you already...
He didn't even know
bit...
I'd recorded it. I turned up at the gig because I was going to meet Ted Hawkins, and I thought, well, I better hear what he does. So I gave the engineer my Sony Walkman and said, plug this into the desk because I'm working with this guy. Well, I, you know, so it was just
you
a recording.
Can take it home, get a feel for him.
Yeah,
that's cool.
So the next day he flies back to America, and the Pan Am air crash, and the there was a big air crash that night, the London to America. I forget what the flight was. Anyway, in the newspaper on the passenger list was a T. Hawkins. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh fuck, shit, he's gone there. But amazingly, it wasn't him. It was another T-Hawk. He'd gone on a different flight. So for a couple of days, I actually thought he'd gone down. Anyway.
Wow. I mean, this is amazing. So 88. So you're producing Ted Hawkins. Yeah. And this comes out later. So what comes through here now? Do you do more production? Do you keep gigging? Do your gigs? Are your gigs growing?
I'll just tell you, just finish on that record.
Around the world?
I'm gigging all over the place. I've just finished on that record. In 2002, we re-released it, Catfish Records, as Nowhere to Run. You're more likely to find it as Nowhere to Run than as I Love You Too.
I'll find
the same album.
I've got quite a lot of Catfish records. I love that label. I mean, I know I'm jumping, but did you record for Catfish?
I
mean,
signed to Catfish, and I did, amazing. I worked with Catfish a lot.
Brilliant.
And I did some of the remastering. I worked on quite a few of their remasters and all sorts.
Of course,
stuff.
We'll.
That's later. So 1988, I'm working with Ted. I'm gigging with Ted with my band. The album comes out. That kind of wasn't managed very well, the whole thing. The label weren't in great shape. It kind of fizzled away.
Were you doing kind of big venues? What size venues are you playing?
Quite big venues, 1,000 or so. Yeah, quite big venues, you know. And that kind of happened and faded out. It never really materialized properly. It was a shame because it was a great project. He was pretty wild and crazy too, so it was quite a hard thing to hold together. I'd got experience from my first album in recorded at Bracknell in the Art Centre's recording studio. I was at Rack. I'd made a record at Rack. I'd been around, you know, the Pogues and the Cure making records. I'd been in the studio listening to how they work. I kind of lifted up a notch. Then in a year later, 89 into 90, I made my second album, Slide Dance. And that, from Diving Duck, is like, whoosh, suddenly it's a different, it's a whole different thing. It's a whole different sound.
In what way? Is your playing improved? Is your songwriting?
Everything.
What is it?
Everything. Yeah. My understanding of the studio, my understanding of how to make a record, my experience, just everything. It's like...
It's amazing.
Like, it's just a complete change.
Same band or different band?
Same band. And that's the same for all of us because we'd all gone on that ride.
That's cool.
You know, we'd all had that same ride.
Who was your drummer at this time then?
At this time, it was Jeffro Robertson. And Jeffro was a local musician in Bracknell. And this was we were about to split from Jeffro. We did Diving Duck and Slide Dance and Ted Hawkins. And Jeffro was about to end his relationship with us because Jeffro was great and I would never ever, you know, I still know where Jeffro is and I love to see him, but we'd grown apart, I think, and it was time to move on. Simon Price became the drummer after Jeffro for projects and still is. I still work with Simon. So we did that. Slide Dance came out and the profile went up much more. Everything started to change. People's reaction to what we were doing was treated different. It was, the whole thing just changed.
Amazing.
From a new band with this new sort of acoustic-y, funky sound. It was more electric. It was more worldly. You know, track one was a pretty heavy reggae track with screaming lap steel on it. There was kind of King Sunny a Day kind of stuff going on it. There was a lot of different. I found my feet a lot more. I felt a lot more comfortable, and we all did. It wasn't just me. It was all of us.
Is
this your all Jack, your own songs now, or and no, are you still no. playing? Are you playing a resonator now?
I'm playing a lot of electric and a resonator, lap steel. The front cover of that album doesn't have me playing. I can just find it here. Doesn't have me playing a resonator. It has me with a bright red electric guitar. Front cover of that looks like that.
Oh yeah, that's an amazing picture. So I'll just explain for the people on the podcast. So it's you've got. So here you are, Michael. You've got a beautiful black silky shirt with white patterns on it. Long curly hair.
Beautiful black silky hair.
Almost Brian May-esque, and you've got one of those red. Plastic national airline guitars from the 60s that Jack White plays.
Yeah, exactly that.
That's exactly a beautiful. That. That's such a cool photograph. And you've stood.
I guess the influence visually. The influence.
Are you stood in front of your grandma's curtains or something?
No, it's Ed Guinness's curtains.
Oh, Guinness's curtains.
Ed Guinness's really? Curtains, and they happen to match my shirt, which matched the guitar.
Oh,
Mark Makin designed this cover, and we picked up on.
Did
the
Mark
theme
do
of the
that?
Shirt. Yeah, yeah. So the shirt.
Mark's a graphic designer as well as a guitar.
Yeah, yeah. So Mark did this cover.
I love that package. I mean, it almost like the graphic design, the pink italic kind of writing. It almost looks like the Dirty Dancing sign or something.
That's exactly what it was. Well, because it's called Slide Dance.
I didn't even see it. All you needed was Patrick Swayze to hold you up above his head.
It was all exactly. But it was all those things. That's what I was kind of trying to. Like Flash Dance and Slide Dance, you know.
Yeah, it's very much so cool.
In a very tongue-in-cheek way. Like.
Well,
a bit David,
this is a good time
a bit David
to say.
Lindley influenced.
Yeah, David Lindley, who's a
and all that. It's a bit LRAOX looking, isn't it? That sort of.
David Lindley, who played with Terry Reid and stuff, who's a great lap steel player and genius and slide player.
Influenced by that. So that happens. The band, you know, we're doing bigger gigs, we're doing more. At the same time, what's happening, and this is kind of interesting really, is that, and it's to do with economics, and it's, you know, is that the duo of me and Ed Guinness is working more and more and more and more because it's more economical. We can go to Europe in one car. We can stay in one hotel room. We can, like, you know the score.
That's why there's two of us in the Washboard Resonators, because it's exactly. a great way of doing the cost and maintaining
Absolutely.
Professional musicianship, and the audience gets a great sound with the two of you.
Yes.
You can fill the sound.
It's more than solo.
Well.
It's bigger than solo. Yeah. You've got to, you know, from where my point of view, having a great rhythm guitarist was like having a band with me. Mm-hmm. I could cover all the material right across of everything without having six people or five or four, whatever it was.
At this point then, Michael, so you're doing more gigs with Ed, and you've got the band project, which sounds to be taking off really well. I'm sure the two probably help each other. But how many gigs a year are you doing, and what kind of gigs, and how often are you out, and all of that?
Out a lot.
Two, all three, four, five, six nights a week,
Probably. Yeah. Places like Marine Fiddler and all over the country. Most of the European work at that time was me and Ed, because it was more economical. So we were building up a whole other reputation and career as an acoustic. That's where the acoustic thing started to build. You know, it was never particularly my intention, although it was always there that I played resonators, and it just started to build around me, really. And that sort of guitar guru thing, because I knew about these instruments with Mark and all that stuff. So a whole other thing was going on. There were kind of two careers happening. There was the acoustic and there was the band. And in that band project, you asked me, Jack, about original material. Well, what started to happen was a friend of mine who sadly died this time, just over a year ago, last April, Terry Clark. Terry Clark, another Reading-based musician, we were both signed to the label, the same label. And Terry, a prolific songwriter and a great songwriter. And it started to happen on Slide Dance. Terry wrote two of the songs on this record. I wrote, there's half a dozen covers, there's a couple of mine, there's a couple of Terry's. By the album that after this, they're all Terry's songs. That started to happen because, hang on, this is really great. This is like Tin Pan Alley stuff. We can write like Goffin and King and that kind of thing. You know, we can approach this in a different way. I can come to you with an idea. You come back at me with this song. This is amazing. I can tell you a story about my life, or I can tell you about finding the Buck of White's guitar and the D from the Daisy Theatre, and you come back with a song about it. This is really cool. So that took. Writing wise, that completely took over, and Terry wrote and co-wrote 40 songs for me and with me over a few albums. So Slide Dance, that all happens. 91, the next thing, big thing comes along, and this is with Terry. Terry travels a lot, or did travel a lot, to Texas. He became friends with a lot of the Austin, Texas crowd at the time. Butch Hancock, Jimmy Dale Gilmore, Jesse Taylor, Joe Ely, all those people. And Jesse Taylor loved one of Terry's songs. Jesse Taylor was one of the ace guitarists from Texas at that point in time. And to cut a long story short, we make a record together, Terry, me, Jesse, and my band in England called Rhythm Oil. And this is in 91, and it took about 3 days while Jesse, in between tour dates, we cut this record, which was a hardcore rock and roll record. It's not resonating, well, there are a few on it, but this is a hard rock and roll record, you know, Texas rock and roll, Irish rock and roll, blues, all of our three things brought in together. My brother, Alan, who I've mentioned to you earlier, lives in Nashville. And Alan was a close friend of John and June Cash and the Cash family. Still is a friend of the Cash family.
As you are, you know.
As you are. Well, Alan had worked with John and June and they became friends. And John, I can't quite remember the exact sequence of events, but Alan gave a cassette of Rhythm Oil to Johnny Cash. via Hugh Waddell. Okay, Hugh Waddell was John's like right hand man at the time, and John got this record. I forget if he offered or if he was asked. I think he kind of offered, but to write the sleeve notes for the album.
Wow.
The only other time he'd ever done it was for Bob Dylan's Nashville Skyline, and for. Well, I don't know the other albums. So there's no point in saying it. Just Bob Dylan's Nashville Skyline is the one.
Michael, did you, from what I understand, you got to spend time with Johnny Cash? Like, what? I mean,
I met him a couple of times.
For me, there's nobody better. So, what's it like hanging out with Johnny Cash? Where do you hang out? What happens?
First time was in the tour bus in Sheffield, up near you, and they'd all given up smoking.
Right.
So. And this was the period where John was wearing his, like the mayor, and his gold, you know, his necklace thing. And it's a bit glitzy at the time. And he's very much being pushed by June into being a certain image. And this is just before the whole thing happened of John solo, you know, with with Rick Rubin and all that, which was a big change. But they were all trying to give up smoking. So John's sitting there holding onto the table like that, you know, it's lovely to meet you, but have you got a cigarette? So that was a pretty amazing time. Spent that evening, met John, met all the sisters, so watched the show in Sheffield and stood by the Carter family, you know, the sisters.
Whereabouts was it? Was it City Hall? Or the
it was the City Hall, yeah. So I stood at the back through the show, sitting just next to where the three sisters were doing the harmony vocals.
Wow.
And that was a very beautiful thing to sit there amongst that.
And had he already written your liner notes by now?
No. This was a few years before. But when I'm so he wrote the liner notes in December 92. This was the album wasn't the label were falling apart. So one minute the label existed, then it didn't, then it did, then it didn't. So this record, Rhythm Oil, did this for a while until it came out, and then it did this for a while when it came out. John wrote the liner notes, and it was an incredible thing. In 94, I went to the Shepherd's Bush Empire to thank John and took Terry to meet him, and we thanked him for writing the notes, and he was very wonderful and a lovely man to spend time with, and he made us feel relaxed and was very, it was a wonderful thing. June told me, this is a good Hawaiian guitar story, and this is a good one, but June said, oh, you play, because I was telling her that I played dobro and stuff, and she said, when I was a little girl, I won't do her accent, but she said, when I was a little girl of 3 years old, I used to sit on Cliff Carlisle's lap, and he used to play the Hawaiian guitar for me and sing songs. And, you know,
well, Cliff Carlisle was a big star in the 30s, and he played a national Jewellian on his lap.
Yeah.
And he's an interesting one, because a lot of his songs are incredibly rude, filthy. And
I don't think he sang of those ones.
No, he wouldn't have sung those to June Carter when she was a little kid, but he was a big star in the 30s. And I think he toured and played with Jimmy Rogers.
Yeah.
And June's telling you, oh, he used to sit on his knee and he'd play guitar for me. That is...
And Jimmy Rogers. She talked about Jimmy Rogers. But they're lovely. They were lovely people. They were lovely, lovely people. And they were, being serious, they were totally real, genuine, hospitable, lovely. He was a Southern gentleman. And something that I find very upsetting whenever I see it, and I don't like it, and I never liked it at the time, was when the movie came out, this thing in the poster, because that was not the man I knew.
No,
that was not the man I met. Not the man I met. That was the Hollywood version.
Yeah, this is
John was a lovely, lovely man with a beautiful sense of humor, and that I, you know, whether it happened or not, I don't know, but that's not the John that my brother knew, and it's not the John I met.
No, the
irony of this whole thing was I was at the Shepherd's Bush Empire that night in 1994. We'd spent an hour or two or whatever it was up in the dressing room socializing and having a good time with John and June. And just as it was ending, John said to me, what are you doing tomorrow? This was a Friday night. I said, I've got a gig tomorrow night. I'm playing at a festival. And funny enough, it was in Bracknell. And he said, you'd be welcome to come. We're playing at Glastonbury tomorrow. If you come to the hotel in the morning and come on the bus with us, you're welcome to come. Yeah. Well, as you guys know, as musicians, you take a gig, you take a gig.
Mm-hmm. You can't take your gig. You can't stop your gigs.
And I was main stage with my band at the festival, so I had to say no. And that was that legendary gig they did, and wonderful. You know, I could have gone along with, but I didn't. So hey.
I mean, what a situation to turn Johnny Cash down to travel with him on the bus to Glastonbury to watch him play. But you had to do your own gig.
And he didn't know what he was heading over to do. You know, he just knew it was a festival. He didn't really know what Glastonbury quite how he was going to be received or how big it was. But yeah, I was invited to go, and
it's on YouTube. I've watched it in the last year. Yeah. That whole thing.
It's
on
wonderful.
YouTube. It's amazing, and he is so good. And the way him and June get the crowd going, it's amazing.
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful show. It's a wonderful show. So that was the show I saw at Shepherd's Bush Empire. So it was the same gig, pretty much. It was. You know, they were lovely people, and it was fantastic. John wrote those sleeve notes. He was very happy for me and for Terry to use them wherever we needed to use them. And I still, to this day, you know, they're a very important part of my career, and they've been very helpful.
Yeah, of course.
And that's what he, and that's why he did it. You know, he said to me, it's a hard road. You've got onto a hard road here, the music business. And if my words help your career, then use it.
Wow. You know. What happens after this then, from the early 90s?
So Rhythm Oil comes out. We do a tour. The record company have pretty much collapsed. There's about 500 copies, if you're lucky, of the album. We did a UK tour. The album won a couple of awards, Import Album of the Year in Austin, Texas, which we never went to. The record company fell apart. It never happened. The tour, we did it on off our own bat. It was a wonderful experience, but it never did what it was supposed to do, is what happened. And Rhythm Oil as a project was never more than the tour we did in the summer of 93. It was wonderful, and it ended. From Rhythm Oil, I then jumped to making my next record, which was in 95. I made, by then I've started doing other projects with other people. I'm doing sessions here and there. I like collaborations. I like playing with other people. Moonbeat was my next album in 1995, which I did with my band, again different band, but Ed was still with me, but other musicians, and with Ron Kavanagh co-producing. Do you know who Ron Kavanagh is? Ron was a Irish kind of rock and roll musician in London, very clever musician, very clever producer, and we got on really well, and we made a great record together. Then that goes from Moonbeat to, by then I'm touring a lot in Europe with the band, without the band. There's all kinds of stuff happening then. It's a busy time. Then after that, National Avenue in 1996, that was made. That's another album. That's another label.
Have you got the rep at the moment for like the, you know, the Resonator man, or are you playing all?
Yeah, I've got that. That started coming from day one in a way. And I also started writing in the early 90s. I got to know the reviews editor of guitarist, Dave Burluck. And I started writing reviews of Resonator guitars for magazines and things like that.
Oh, interesting. New guitars, were there new Resonators being made now?
There was National that just started out. There were a couple of companies in the Far East producing. Yeah, I'd kind of become the person that the guitar magazines went to when it was for Slide or Resonator guitars. There was a feature in another magazine, Slide feature, George Thorogood, me, Ry Cooder, and a few, you know, that kind of thing was happening.
Wow.
I was the one that they came to in this country for Slide. It was like that, which was very cool, you know, it was great.
And it's another side of the music business, isn't it? Now you're writing and helping in the magazines, you're this source of knowledge and information, you've promoted, you've gigged, you know, you've put on gigs at the venues like you mentioned. So you've seen the whole side of the industry, you've produced. You know, you've really seen the industry from lots of different sides, haven't you? Which is interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting, and in a way, they all helped each other. They all acted as catalysts for each other. It didn't get in each other's way, you know. And I think the magazines liked working with me because I was a known musician who was able to write and talk, you know. I remember my first label, when I signed my first label, you know, he said to me, I like working with you because you can play, you can talk, you can be interviewed, you can write, you know, I can put you anywhere and you'll deal with the situation, whereas a lot of people can't. Mm. So it's good to have that. And if you look at a lot of the successful people, some of them don't do any of it, but a lot of them can. They know how to handle themselves. You know, I think that's important. So yeah, I was doing the guitar guru thing, if you want, whatever you want to call it. I was getting known for that. I mean, there was some nutty time. You know, this was before 9/11, so you could fly with any amount of anything you wanted to. And I mean, I remember flying to Switzerland one day with six guitars, you know, like just turning up at Heathrow with a stack of them on the trolley. You know, it wasn't a problem. you can't do, well, you can do it now, but it'll cost you a lot of money.
A pretty penny, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, it was an interesting time. I was making records. It was working really well. It was rising. There were a couple of dead periods, you know, that happens. Music business is a hard thing to maintain without management constantly there, without backing. It's a hard thing to maintain. So there were downs as well as ups.
So we're in the mid-90s, and it sounds like you're really busy with all this stuff. Now, I know that, you know, by this point, or around this time, you start to have a family and stuff. So that's now a part of your life, isn't it? How do you deal with that then? Like, is there a way of kind of taking all that kind of stuff on and managing it?
Yeah, somehow. I was very lucky. Sue, my partner, was very happy for it to be like it was. Rosanna was born in 89, Jessie in 92, so two daughters. So, yeah, mid-90s, they're little girls, you know. And yeah, I mean, I was traveling a lot. So it was, when I was home, I was around, you know. But yeah, Sue was, it was amazing. Sue loved it how it was and was happy for it to be how it was. So
fantastic.
We were all very lucky that we had that unit, you know.
Yeah, and you're well. Living the dream by the sound of it. In the end.
It was a pretty amazing time. It was when I think back about it.
And you're back in the south. You're back in near London, I guess.
I'm living in the area I live in now, which is in Buckinghamshire. It was a busy time, you know. And also, what started to happen around that time was the cheap flights started to happen. You know, the easy jets and the Ryanair and all that stuff. That opened the doors up for musicians incredibly, because you could afford to take a band into Europe to do a gig or two gigs, you know, if they're decent pay. But that was, you know, I forget what year it was now, maybe a bit later, early 2000s. I mean, every weekend, I mean, I think I knew everyone on every Ryanair flight. You know, it was just every weekend we were somewhere else. It made it very easy. Something drastic or something dramatic has happened since then that stopped all that, but that's another discussion.
So we go through the Moonbeat thing and you're working like you're saying. So I remember reading somewhere a long time ago, when was it around 2000 when you did you do something for Terry Gilliam?
No, I didn't. I did an album in Canada.
Right.
And I never really quite got to the bottom of this. I did an album in Canada in 1999, which was never released. The project fell apart due to problems between me and the management.
Right.
One of the tracks supposedly ended up in a Terry Gilliam film, and I don't know what happened. I've never managed to track it down.
Oh, my goodness. How strange.
It was a bit strange. I don't quite know what happened. That was in 99, yeah. And there was also a period where Mark Makin, talking about, you know, the guitar thing, I'm going to go back a couple of years, but in 94, Mark and I were very close to making a TV documentary, which was about national guitars, which was going to be called Shine On.
Oh, yes.
And we had verbal agreements from quite a few big names, you know, George Harrison, the song I recorded, a Terry Clark song I recorded called Shine On, John had agreed to sing as the title song of the film. Johnny Cash had agreed to sing it.
Oh, it's flipping out.
So it was all very, but in 94, what happened was the ITV network was gonna fund this project. And it was when the Beatles made their anthology series of documentaries, and of course all the funding they had for music documentaries went to that, and we didn't get our funding, but we were so close like that to making this film.
That's a film I would kill to see.
It would have been a wonderful thing.
In the title, George Harrison turning up in it, because he had a lot of nationals and residents.
There was George, there was various people that we'd approached.
You and Mark.
and all sorts of people that were going to be involved. And there was a pretty good A-list stars that were going to be in it.
Any people like Mark Knopfler or anybody like that involved?
Mark was you know, he'd been approached and he was happy to be part of it. Nice. George, Mark, I forget who they all were now, but it was a wonderful thing, and we were very, very close. And then there was a call one day. I'm afraid the Beatles got the money. Well, they would, wouldn't they? You know. And it was a wonderful series. So
it was great.
They got it.
So I think I feel like for the guitar, I can't believe I'm bringing it up, but I feel like we should touch on some of the guitars you've got and see a few behind you and how you got into your collection of like Nationals and stuff. But are there any other points you want to bring up between, so from, well, the last 20 years, basically? What's kind
about
of
guitars?
About anything. We've reached the early 2000s now.
In 2000 I signed to Catfish Records. To tell this very quickly, I signed to Catfish Records, who were a back catalogue blues label run by two young guys in Guildford who were pushing and hip and cool and presenting it in a new way, and they signed me, and we put together a record of my back catalogue of blues stuff on other albums, and it was called King Guitar, which was a compilation album.
So solo album?
It was from all across. It was a Michael Messer album, but it was music from all different projects, but all blues. And they put it out, and it was the most successful album to that at that point that I'd had. And in May 2001, it was the number one blues album in America, and it started to really like, whoa, this is really going,
you know,
and it was really good. And then a year later, I made Second Mind, the Catfish.
That's the one I've got.
Right, and that was kind of pushing the area that Skip McDonald, Little Axe, Moby, myself, and a few other people were using samples and loops and pushing that area, and it was kind of very new for its time. I didn't know about Moby when I made the record. I didn't know about it until later, but we were doing a very similar kind of thing, except mine was live band rather than computers and samples.
So this is the point. I've seen footage of you youngster now, but you were playing on stage with somebody doing decks and stuff, and it was very electro meets blues meets music. It's
exactly
a really
that.
Cool mix of stuff.
Yeah,
on a resonator.
Yeah, electric guitar and resonator. So that's Ed Guinness's son, Louis.
Oh right.
So Louis grew up with our music, right? So when Louis was 4 years old, we were making the first album. So we're making the first album, and Louis drawing dinosaurs on the floor. You know. 2002, Louis in the studio, plugged in with, what used to happen was I would go around to Ed, and Louis as a teenager was into scratching and stuff with the decks. And we'd be sitting having a play, the two of us, just acoustic, and in Ed's music room with the turntable on the table. And Louis would be in there and said, well, you know, you want to join in? Come on, you know, put a blues record on rather than whatever he was into. But it was just put a blues record on and scratch with that. And it started from there, just the three of us organically, acoustically, turntable and two acoustic guitars. And it was like, hey, this is pretty cool. I like this. So when we made Second Mind, I got a pile of blues records and I took them to the studio and I plugged Louis in with his turntable. And funnily enough, a couple of people in the band found it a bit hard to cope with playing with him doing this stuff. So I just said, well, don't put him in their mix. And I said, just Louis, just do whatever you want to do while we're playing, just do it. We can always go back and do it again if it's a good idea. We can sort it out, but just go for it. And we'd work a few things out before, like, is that in key? Yeah, that's in, yeah, great, great, great. And that's how it happened. It was completely organic. And what I loved about it was that it was not what other people were doing. R.L. Burnside, Skip McDonald, you know, Little Axe, Moby, they were going, and blues people go, whoa, yeah, whoa, yeah, what, you know, that kind of, that wasn't what we were doing. We were using it filmically, like letting a blues record run for a period, and even duetting, which I couldn't put on record. I tried to, but Chess wouldn't let me. I used to do a duet with Muddy on Rolling and Tumbling.
Cool.
So we'd sing it together and we'd take it in turns with the guitar, because Louis would be coming in and out with the... And I approached Leonard Chess about it, and I sent him the track, and he said, it's amazing, it's beautiful. He said, but I want more than 100% of the track if you use it. And I said, well, that's like, is that a no? He said, no, but I want more than 100%. I said, I understand. I said, so it was all very friendly, but he just said, you can't do it.
I'd love to hear some of that. That sounds mad.
It was mad. Really good. It was cool. And we did Manish Boy with Muddy duetting with me. And we also did quite a lot of stuff with Captain Beefheart.
Right.
You know, I got that blues, man. I got that, all that stuff. And, you know, using Captain Beefheart in there. But it was very difficult to, we could do it on stage because you could just, on the PRS form, you could just put the real detail, but you couldn't record it. It was really difficult. It was really difficult. You know,
it's like you've got people now to get the publishing for samples. It's so complex, isn't it? Yeah. Just even break beats or, you know, yeah, guitar. Or whatever, and it's so such a minefield unless you've got a massive management that can
absolutely
afford to deal with the admin, I guess.
Yeah. But so we just weren't able to, you know.
But it's a great project.
Got lots of that, haven't it? Yeah, the record's got a lot of stuff.
I was just gonna say, Michael, that like one of the things that I find astonishing about you, whether it was you talk about the rhythm oil stuff, and you're talking about the electric band and mixing the lap steel and all that kind of stuff, the sample stuff. What's really interesting is the world music that you're mixing in later on. We'll talk about it as we go through the your life, but the world music you make with the Indian guys like Manish Pringle and stuff, these Indian virtuoso musicians, you've always been taking this blues and this roots thing, but mixing it with other stuff. And I think hopefully if people, you know, listen to this and they want to listen to you, you know, there's some really interesting stuff happening throughout your entire career. And I hope people discover that.
I've always wanted to do that with the blues music. It's what the people that I grew up on were doing.
Yeah, exactly.
It's what Led Zeppelin were doing. It's what the Rolling Stones were doing. It's you know, it's my way of doing that. I always loved about, you know, Muddy in particular, because he grew old as a blues man, as did B.B. King, and John Lee Hooker, the three of them, very much the same material. Changes, but you keep hearing those same songs, the different band, you know, Muddy doing I Can't Be Satisfied, and Chess with Willie Dixon, with Johnny Winter, with Rory Gallagher, with, you know, and each time it's like a different, and I always loved that, and I kind of wanted to do that with my own music. I like the idea of mixing blues with those other styles rhythmically. You know, the reggae thing. Ed is a great, Ed Genis is a fantastic reggae player, you know, skanking guitar. So it just felt natural for us to do Oscar Woods stuff with that rather than the rhythm that we all know. And it just seemed natural. The Indian thing, Pingle, his name's Pingle, not Pringle, Pingle.
Oh, sorry. That's
okay, Manish. But the Indian thing, yeah, I bought an album. That's okay. I bought an album nearly 40 years ago called Call of the Valley. A musician called Bridge Bhushan Kabra, Hawaiian, Indian slide guitar player. And as soon as I heard this record, I just thought, I have got to play with someone like this. I have got to find a way in my life of playing blues with, I understand this, you know. It was a guitar in open D tuning. And I understood, even if I didn't understand the ragas and the scales, I understood something more. There was something it wasn't until I met Manish in Mumbai in 2013 that I was.
You were in Mumbai when you met him. So how did that happen then?
I went to play at a festival, the Mahindra Blues Festival with Second Mind. And through Facebook, I'd been in touch with Manish, and he said, oh, if you're in town, I'll show you around. And I went over to his place, and we had a jam. And the moment we started playing, I didn't have a guitar with me. He had a Moen Veena. I started playing You Got to Move. And he joined in. And within seconds, we thought, oh, this is we've got to do this. We've got to do this.
So his Indian music and your, for want of a better word, Western music, straight away there was something that like a synergy that happened, and it wasn't difficult or hard to do. It was easy. It just felt
straight away. First night within, yeah. But there was a, so if I, just that Indian thing. We're going some tangents here. Okay, the Indian thing was, so I went to. The Indian story is a strange one, the whole thing.
Tell us.
I was booked with the Second Mind Band to play the Mahindra Blues Festival, which is a big festival. And I was booked alongside, everyone's billed equally, some big, big names. It was wonderful. We were flown out there, put in a 25-star hotel or whatever it was. It was all very wonderful. And before we left home, you know, we all know about India, and we all know about India, Indian food. And I don't mean Indian food in a good way. I mean what it can do to you in India. And I said to the band, this is a very, very important gig. We're being paid a silly amount of money to fly to India and do a gig. There's a 24-hour gap between the flight landing and us going on stage. We're going to a very good hotel. I don't want anyone to leave the hotel and eat anything other than in the hotel, because we have to be on the stage. And this is a rule. This isn't just a, I'm not like that with my band.
No.
This is a serious, this was a lot of money being paid out.
We don't want any dicky tummies, guys.
Okay. So we arrive at this beautiful hotel and we all go for a meal. And an hour and a half or so. Sue, my wife, I smuggled Sue in as our manager. You know, I mean,
that's brilliant.
I'd also said, I want to stay and spend a week, 10 days in Mumbai afterwards. Can you recommend a hotel that I could stay in? And they said, don't worry, it's on us. You're our guest. 2 hours after the first meal in the hotel, I start to feel ill. 2 hours later, I'm more ill than I've ever been in my life. Big time ill. A few hours after that, there's a doctor coming in, and there's the promoter of the festival saying, give him a shot, make him go on stage. And I'm saying, no, I'm too ill. And the doctor said, no, you've got to understand, he's too ill to do anything. It's dangerous. So the band flew home, and the gig was cancelled.
Oh.
And because they couldn't reschedule it, it was over. I was too ill to do the gig, and the band flew home. They'd said, "But you're all right. Stay, have your holiday with your wife. It's fine."
Your manager.
I was so ill, man. I didn't really want to do much. Manish, I'd been in touch with, and I called Manish and said, I'd love you to show me around, but I've been so ill, man. I don't know if I can even come over. He said, well, I'll tell you what, come over. My wife cooked you some nice food, and it'll be gentle on your stomach, and I'll come and pick you up. So Sue and I go over to Manish's flat. He picks us up from this very grand hotel. He thinks he's picking up Elton John or something. You know, it's, comes into the foyer, Mr. Messer, you know, it's a big place. Get to Manish's place, and Moanvina on the floor. Immediately I grabbed the first, give me that thing, you know. And I had a slide with me, some picks, but I didn't have an instrument. I started playing You Gotta Move. He started picking along. This is fantastic. We can play together. This is amazing. So we had a lovely evening, and I left that night saying to Manish, I will get you to London. Somehow I will get you to London, which I did. Via a friend of Manish's, we were put in touch with Gudane Riot, tabla player, who's the tabla player in probably in Europe these days. And we had this trio formed in this room in September 2013 to do a gig at the Troubadour in London.
Wow, good venue.
Lovely little venue. And it was all set up by a friend who basically was an angel over the whole thing. He set it up, and he helped fund the whole thing. It was wonderful. we did that gig. We did the guitar festival at Olympia. Manish and I did a gig and a workshop. Everyone loved what we did, and it was all like, "Hey, this is really interesting." The gig we did was a classical. We did two sets. Manish and Gurdain did classical, and then the three of us did a blues jazzy kind of thing, which was the basis of what we were going to do.
I so when you say classical, is that classical Indian music?
Yes, classical Indian.
Yeah.
So, and it was great. The audience loved it. We loved it. It was an amazing moment. We played some of the stuff that became our repertoire. But it was jammed, and we'd had a rehearsal here. We formed a few ideas. And one of the things we formed just before it was, I didn't really want there to be two gigs. I wanted it to be one gig. And we were sitting here one night, and I said to Manish, how can we get you play Indian classical in a blues, not after the blues, but in it? And then we just came up with this thing of we were playing Rolling and Tumbling, you know, which was, I haven't got a slide in, man, hang on, I'll get one. We were playing Rolling and Tumbling, and it was the personal simplest problem. It was kind of the simplest little idea, really. You know, we were just we're playing, and I said, "What? How can you get what you're doing into that?" And suddenly, I just said, "I don't need to do anything other than if you guys take off, I can just vamp." So,
yeah. So you can vamp
while I'm doing that. While I'm doing that, the guys can do whatever they want as long as I don't let go.
No, so what
suddenly it became like, oh, this is wild, man. This is very cool. And as it ended, we're back into it. Whoa, this is really good. And that was how it was born, really, the idea. And then it started to happen. A year later, we didn't do anything. Manish went back to India. We stayed in touch. It was all very exciting. I got a tour organized. My friend who used to be the director of WOMAD, Thomas Brumman, he helped me put a tour together in the UK, got some funding and helped me set a tour up. I booked a studio to record an album at the end of the tour. Hang on, I missed a bit there, sorry. Before that happened, we went to Switzerland. I got us a gig in Switzerland at the Lugano Festival. A friend of mine ran, Norman Hewitt, another friend who's sadly not with us anymore, but Norman ran this amazing festival and had Swiss funding. So it was like, hey, this is we can make projects happen. I told Norman about the project and played him the Troubadour recording. And he said, you got to come. We got there. We did the first night. Open air big stage, and we hadn't played together. This was August 14, and we did the Troubadour in September 13. And it's stiff. The gig didn't go very well at all because we were on a big stage, and we sort of hadn't really a couple of ideas were there, but not properly. Gig didn't go very well. A few people standing there a bit bored looking at us. And after the gig, we said, we've got another four gigs for this festival. Right, tomorrow morning, up early, crack of dawn, we're going to make a band. Because it wasn't really a band, it sort of was. So that morning, we met up, and we just worked. You know what we did in Rolling and Tumbling? How we made that? We've got to do that to everything. We've got to make this integral. Like, you can't tell which is the blues, which is the Indian. And also, I like Indian classical music. I don't know much. I know enough to. This stuff happens in Indian classical music, like a turnaround in blues or a middle eight in a pop song. There's things like that in a raga, like there are certain things that happen. And I would say, I want us to bring those things into what we do. You know, when it gets really exciting at the end of a raga, how do you do that? How does it go up? How do you make that happen? Oh, what you mean? That. So we brought it all together. We rehearsed it up. That night we played the biggest gig of the weekend, probably 5,000-6,000 people in a square. That wow. place went wild, man. They wow. went nuts. They went nuts. It was like, it was just, they went nuts. And we had the tabla that turned up pretty loud so that the bass was coming through pretty heavily. And we stormed it that night. And that was when it was like, oh, okay, this is what we're doing. And that was what took us forward. But it was sort of born out of, there was this moment at Manish's where it was like, yeah, this is definitely on. Then there was the Troubadour, which is, hey, this is really cool. We like doing this. And these ideas work. And then we met a year later and it all went, but within hours we were back up. And yeah, now we've toured together for 6 years.
It's lovely to hear about the kind of the different cultures and how you kind of made that work. I find that fascinating that you could do that. Now, what I'm just going to say is, Jack, how are we doing for time? Because we were in the second part now.
As I was saying, we're just coming up to an hour. So I think if we minutes, we also need to do our ending questions.
Okay, that's fine. So we've got about five. So probably no more than 10 minutes to finish this up, which is good. So. Jack asked a question a while ago. I wanted just to like do the history and do you know, talk about your Indian stuff because it's fascinating. So Jack was wondering about
I didn't mean to, but I just thought
no, it's great.
No, it's amazing.
I tell you what I like about that story. I like to tell the fact that it wasn't just this moment of woo, off we go. There was this moment of we did this gig and it was like we all looked at each other and thought, oh God, what are we going to do? That wasn't what we meant to do at all. And we were all on this great big stage and it was like, oh God.
I think all musicians can relate to the idea that you might go on stage and as far as you're concerned, you're ready. And just for some reason, it doesn't hit the mark. But then you might find a way to bring it back or to fix that later on, whatever that might be, to get yourself in the headspace or to, you know, it's a fascinating tale. And I just think good on you guys. I mean, the size of the appendages just to try that in front of those people without playing for over a year. It's amazing. I mean, it shows that you're willing to take chances and to do something interesting, you know. And does it work sometimes?
We enjoy being with each other. Mm. You know, we have a great time. And there's a mutual appreciation for what we can all do. You know, we all respect each other. And we're all prepared to listen to each other with ideas and to... what are we going to do here? How do we make this? And now we know each other better. It's easier because, you know, we can say it without, it's so much easier. It's so much easier. I can play a tune and say, how do we make this sound Indian?
And they are massively like amazing virtuosos, these guys. I remember you telling me once that they practice all the time you're driving.
Well, Indian, it's a classical music form.
It's a tradition, isn't it? Yeah.
It's not just a tradition. It is a tradition, but bring in Nigel Kennedy to play violin. You know, you get a pretty good violin player there. And Gurdane is an incredible tabla player. Manish is one of the handful of four or five top players, you know, Indian slide guitar in the world. No doubt about it. And we have a ball doing it. And it's, for all three of us, it's different.
Sounds amazing. I just think in the resonator guitar world, and I think a lot of people that know who you are resonator guitar fans and players. You have this really wonderful position, as well as being one of the world's, you know, experts, obviously, and one of the world's top players. You started manufacturing your own resonator guitars. And before I even knew who you were, I played some out and about. And I was like, these are as good as, or, you know, as good as like the American, I've got some here, American Nationals. So how does one go about starting up a company making your own resonator guitars? Like, how does that work? How do you do that?
Okay, I'll tell you how it happened very, very quickly. Never, it was a million miles from my thoughts. Never dreamed anything like it would ever happen. I told you before, I was writing reviews for magazines. I would get various Far Eastern guitars in for review, and I would be pretty scathing about them. And sometimes to the point of the magazine almost not wanting to publish them because the maker was one of their biggest advertisers. That kind of thing was happening. But I always reviewed them honestly, and I was very critical. And I used to say, basically, well, it's a bit like the Eric Morecambe joke, you know, playing all the right notes in the wrong order. I'd say you've got all the right bits, but you don't know how to put them together. What's going on here? You know, you've got a bit of brass and some wood and a resonator, but it's all wrong. Eventually, what happened was a member of my forum contacted me in 2008, early 2008, and he said to me, I've been reading your reviews. I've been in touch with a little family business in Shanghai. They make resonator guitars. I'd like to bring a guitar to show you because I think that there might be some business to be done. Oh, really? Okay. Yeah, okay. Bring it around. And he happened to be working quite near where I live. He brought this guitar around, which was a single cone steel bodied instrument. It had many things wrong with it, but it was the best copy of a 30s Nationals that I'd ever seen, bar none. But it had lots of things wrong with it, of which I took to pieces on my dining room table and said, this, and this. And he said, would you like to go into business? I said, what do you mean? He said, I've been talking to these people. With a small investment each, we could bring over 50 guitars and we could start a company. I don't know if I want to start a company, really. You know, I don't mind putting my name to it and being Michael Messer, but I don't really want to run a guitar business. It's not what I do. Okay, well, I'll be your distributor and you be Michael Messer. How's that? Okay, that sounds good. What do we need to do? Well, we need you to design the guitar, and we'll go from there. I said, okay, steel body, blah, 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 blah. And he said, no, we need more than one. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you can't start a company with one thing. You need a range. So let's have two, shall we? Okay, let's have a brass one and a steel one. How's that? Okay, let's not have a stylo. Everyone has a stylo. Let's have the first stylo, a Lightning, which probably conversation with Mark had probably helped that, because Mark and I talk a lot. So Mark was in on the conversation. So he may have well been part of that decision to make the Lightning. Mm-hmm. He drew the first Lightning that they copied. So he drew that out, that Lightning on the... So yeah, it probably was partly due to him. So we had the Lightning and the Blues was the idea. And we worked out, Robin and I, that if we bought these guitars and had them shipped to the UK, even if we had to sell them at cost on eBay to get rid of them, we wouldn't lose our money and it would have been quite an interesting experience. Hmm. Once they're ordered, I start telling people on my forum, I've started a company, I'm selling guitars. Really? Well, there's a steel bodied one and there's a brass bodied one.
And what year is this now, Michael?
This was 2008. And the minimum order we could do it wasn't about the minimum with the factory, it was the minimum we could do to make up, to not lose money, was 25 of each. It took 3 months for the 25 of each to arrive in the UK. By the time they got here, they were all sold.
Wow.
No one had ever seen one. So completely, as a leap of faith on my reputation and my word, everyone had spent their money. Wow, this is amazing.
This is amazing.
Yes. By the time I had to put a second order in before the first order arrived for another 50, because we were still playing safe, you know, didn't really know what was what. Didn't know anything about the business, really. And to cut a long story short, it's been the same ever since. Demand it outweighs supply and has done for the last 13 years. And I don't want to analyze it too much. It's amazing. I mean, Robin and I parted company in 2014, not because we didn't get on, quite the opposite. It was because MM Guitars had become too big for him to handle. He only set this up as a part-time thing. He was retired and suddenly he's full-time MM Guitars, and, you know, non-stop. Amazing. So I took it over. I brought in luthier Dave King, who an old friend of mine. He does all the setups. It's a very nice, comfortable situation. I don't want to be Paul Reed Smith or Leo Fender. I'm happy to just, I don't want it to take over the world. I've had a few offers where I could be a big, real guitar company. I don't want to be. I just like it how it is, because I'm primarily a musician. In the last year, I haven't been because of the pandemic. So the guitar business has been all I've had. But normally it's my part-time thing. It's something I do when I'm not touring, when I'm, so I can control it as it is. Any bigger with any employees or anything, I don't want that.
Well, this is a really nice thing just to say about your business for maybe people that don't know about it and might find this, is that it's basically you, isn't it? And you the guitars come to your house, they get set up by Dave King, you do some final tweaks, you sort them out, you wrap them up nice, you send them out.
Yeah.
Is that fair? And it's really, exactly, you really check everything to the nth degree so that people are getting a really beautiful thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's the gorgeous guitars, and they're very kind of, you know, we're talking in sort of real terms now here in 2021, we're talking sort of 550, 600, 600, maybe £700 for these things, aren't we? And they have an equal to things that are triple, quadruple the money, easily.
Yeah. It's love amazing. I do it for passion. Yeah, it's nice to earn some money out of it as well.
Of course, but
I do it because I love it. I do it properly, the service and everything, because... I mean, the service I'm giving is what you would get if you're buying a £5,000 guitar made for you. But I like to give that service because the person that's buying that guitar from me, that's the guitar that they can afford to buy. And £600 to that person is the same as £10,000 to that person. Mm. So I just want to treat people the way I want to be treated. And going back to my first job when I was, we talked about 4 hours ago when this interview started, was when I was in a hairdresser's, and I always remember my boss saying to me, never count the money in the till, always count happy customers.
Well, I think that coupled with what you said about you know, keeping supply and demand and not outgrowing what your original goal was, that's what Ian McGuire said, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, Ian and I talk a lot, we get on well, and we share, you know, we chat a lot because we both have the same philosophy. Nothing is too much trouble. I want my customer to get the most beautiful guitar they've ever seen, and whatever it takes to give them that, that's fine. I don't have any overheads. I do it in my own time. If it takes me an hour longer than it should, if it costs me a £10 or £50 more than it should, I'm not worried. I just want them to have the best guitar they've ever seen, and that's all I want. And that's it for me. And yes, it's nice to have some money in the bank to eat, but you know what's nicer? Do you know what's nicer? To get the email saying, that's the most amazing service and the most amazing guitar. I can't believe you've done this for me.
Amazing.
That, to me, is, that's my, you know, that does it for me.
It's a wonderful thing. And I think we are going to do another podcast later in the line where we're going to do more detail about your guitar business for various reasons, because you've told me about the manufacturing process and going to China. It's fascinating, so we will look at that another time. But
okay,
I love doing it
is the long, you know,
it's clear, and it's one of those rare things in the world where something, you know, you people might say something's too good to be true. Well, this is one of those rare things where it is just too good, and it's for the money and what the product is, it's exceptional, and it's really good. So we basically, I'd like just to know a little bit about your forum, because your forum is where I got started on this. I found a guitar secondhand and information, and it was a wonderful thing. Now your forum is a worldwide resource where people can talk about resonators. I'd love to know a little bit about the setup of that, a few minutes. And then we've got a few questions, and we'll just ask if there's anything else we've missed, then we'll bring it to an end.
Okay, the forum has started off, it's been in its current state since 2003. Mm-hmm. But before that, when I first started a website off, my first website I built in 98.
Wow.
And I put a guest book on it.
Really does.
Okay. I put a guest book on it, and people used to say, hey man, cool gig last night, what tuning were you in, you know, that kind of
thing. Right, yeah,
just a little guest book thing. And then people started asking me more serious questions, like, oh, I've got a 1930 National and I want to do this and that, and this little guest book, which is in one straight line, like a bit like a sort of social media thing, they don't have them anymore, but yeah. It was getting too much. It was like, this is ridiculous. I started looking at forums and thought, oh, if I could do a forum, do I want a forum? I don't know, maybe I do. Okay, well, let's have a go. So I hunted around and I found Pro Boards and set it up. however many years that is now, it's still going. 18 years on, it's still going.
18 years you've got the forum. And I mean, and a lot of traffic, I think.
Yeah, it varies. It varies from, like I just looked this morning, this weekend, the traffic was, well, in the last 24 hours was 9,200 people.
Wow.
It varies, you know. There's about 3,000 members. Everyone that joins it is interested and serious about the subject. It's not social media, it never has been, and any social conversation of any kind is removed. I don't want a joke, I don't want hello, how are you, I don't want where do you live, I don't want anything other than music. It doesn't have to be slide guitar, it doesn't have to be resonators, music, only music and musical instruments and records and stuff related, but no social media at all. Well, a few of the regulars crack a few jokes and say hello, fine. But I'm very strict about that.
You are. But what's really nice about it is you see a newbie pop into it and be like, oh, I've just bought a resonator. What strings have I put on? And we've all answered it a million times. But you or the people say, well, this is what works for me. And they get this amazing amount of information. And then you also end up then with some very, 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 very kind of in deep collecting people talking about the very fine details about, say, vintage resonators.
Yeah.
Helping each other along. This is original, that isn't original.
Absolutely.
And one of the most amazing things I love about it, I just love going to the search bar and putting in, like, say, Robert Johnson or Blind Boy Fuller. And then because it's been going so long, there's all these previous, like, conversations, even some from like 10 years ago.
Someone
saying, oh, well, this record was recorded here, and this record, he did it with this, and this was this guitar. And you can find, I mean, for a nerd into old blues music.
It goes along, it's deep, there's a lot of
you can find anything, almost anything on there.
Honestly,
I just think one of the great things you've done for all of music and resonator land is you're the one person that's made the space where we can all kind of truly get together. And like social media, as we know, it's a pretty, if we're honest, it's nowadays especially, it's a pretty evil and bad thing. But like, this is a place where just people can go and have conversations,
exactly,
and share without it being a problem. And you've done that. It's amazing.
And just to finish off on that, one thought on that subject of the forum. From 1998, 2003 through to MM Guitars in 2008, people I know, friends of mine, used to say, why do you put so much time into it? You know, and you ought to monetize it in some way. You ought to charge people. You ought to do this. I say, no, I don't want to. I don't want to. It's not about that. Eventually, when MM Guitars started, which was not connected to it at all, it is now a perfect little catalyst for that and for my gigs. It is the as a business thing, if you look at it from a bit, you know, it's a pleasure. It's not why I run it, but as a business thing, it's as big a magnet as making an album or going on a tour or anything. It sells my records. It sells my concerts. It sells my guitars. It's amazing.
It is amazing. And it's the thing about community, I think, in the true sense of the word, like community and belonging and being around the like-minded people, then it's just going to create that goodwill and that desire for people to be a part of the community, even in the flesh. You know,
it's a real community.
10 quid to get in, but we can all be sort of friends then.
Yeah. Brilliant. But it's a real community. We've met.
It is a community.
10 years ago, 2010, 11 years ago, we had a meeting, a slide guitar festival, which maybe we should do again someday. That was good fun, you know, where everyone most people on the forum and others got together and actually met. But yeah, I don't see it as a virtual community. I see it as a real community, and that's really important. Yeah, I love running it. It's running it isn't the word. I'm the host. You know, I don't feel like I'm running it. I feel like I'm looking after it.
Somebody needs to keep an eye on it, because otherwise
someone has to.
Things can get a bit carried away, and you're very good at moving stuff around and making it.
I try to see every conversation that's happening, even if I don't join in. I just enjoy it. It's fun, you know.
Unfortunately, we said this before we started. We said, right, we're probably going to go into two parts on this, and we're going to feel like we're going to miss a load of stuff. There's things I can remember talking about that we've probably run out of time to talk about. Is there anything else you'd like to share before we do the final questions and finish up?
Ooh.
Or Jack, is there anything that
you
want to know about?
This has been amazing, because you've tapped into some things that, this has been a pretty in-depth interview. You know, it's amazing.
Well, I mean, our whole aim with Philip Doohan's interviews is just trying to get people's stories out there who aren't necessarily there. You know, if people look you up, they won't have found out how you got into it necessarily. That's the, you know, sort of what we're trying to do with everyone we're interviewing.
Great. No, it's great. The time, it's great. And do you know what I like as I get older about this stuff too, about telling these stories? I get more truthful the older I get. Because it's the cool stuff doesn't matter. When I first started doing this, and I did, I've done a lot of interviews. I've done, you know, interviewed on Radio One or whatever. There's no way I'd have told people I was a hairdresser. There's no way I'd have told people.
I think that's one of the best things and one of the most amazing things I've heard today, because Chuck it shows your life. To know what you wanted to do.
No, I'm not. This isn't name dropping, but this is true, right? This is true. I met Chuck Berry. My brother David was putting him on, whenever it was, 10, 12 years ago. He did a Chuck Berry tour, and I spent an evening with him in Oxford. And Chuck Berry was a ladies' hairdresser.
He was?
And yeah, he was. And I asked him something that I've never been able to ask any other musician ever, was that, you see, one of the things you do when you're training to be a hairdresser is you learn to use scissors, right? And that is constant thumb movement on your right hand, okay? And it's a constant thing. And when you learn to do hairdressing, you learn to move your thumb without moving your fingers, because otherwise you cut people's heads off if you do this with a pair of scissors. Only one blade moves. And I've always thought, a lot of people, as a musician, people compliment my right hand and my thumb. Oh, your thumb, Matt, really strong thumb. The way you play is your thumb. It's always people say it. And I've always thought it comes from hairdressing. And I was able to say to Chuck Berry, do you think hairdressing helped you with your guitar playing? How do you mean, man? Well, the scissors and the thumb. He said, yeah, I never thought of it before, but yeah, I'd never thought of that before.
Wow.
So we had this very strange conversation, Chuck Berry and I, about hairdressing and guitar playing, which I don't know if either of us had ever had before.
No, and just don't ask him about cameras in ladies' toilets. That's something
I wouldn't ask him about.
You don't want to go there.
But I liked him a lot.
Do you know what? There's one more thing. It's amazing, but there's one more thing. I know we're getting to the end and we do need to draw this to a conclusion. We could talk forever, but there's one thing you told me once when I rang for some advice about sliding. You helped me with it. It was really nice. I've got it here. It's wonderful. But you told me a story which absolutely brought tears to my eyes. And I just thought it was amazing. It was about Taj Mahal and playing was it Germany or somewhere?
Mm-hmm.
What struck me about the story you told, I'd love to hear it again and get it on the podcast.
It was the day my father died.
Yeah, but it was probably one of the most moving things I've heard about being what it is to be a musician and what it is to sort of I guess psychologically be a musician, and you know, the idea of the show must go on and all that kind of stuff. It was an astonishing story. Like, can you tell me that again just so I can hear it?
August 2006.
Yeah.
I flew with Ed Genis to Germany to play at a festival. Got to the hotel, checked in there. Taj Mahal arrived. We're all in the foyer there. There's some handshaking going on, staff. My mobile phone rings back then, little whatever it was, Nokia thing, little thing about this big rings. My father had died. And I think Taj was Ed was with me, and my father just died, you know. So I'm standing there, sort of tears rolling down my face on Taj Mahal's shoulder, which is a bit of a strange experience in itself, you know.
A legendary performer from played with the Rolling Stones.
A legend, someone whose music I've loved all my life.
Incredible performer.
Since I was a young teenager. I'm standing there and I'm wrapped up in Taj Mahal's arms, you know, and just lost my dad. And he and his guys were just so nice to me. They were wonderful. They said, do you want us to do this? We were opening for them. Taj said, do you want me to do your show? And I said, I know what happened. Sorry. I tried to get home. So I hear this news. I made phone calls. I panic.
Where were you again? Was it Germany?
Yeah, we were in the south of Germany. I can't think of the name, it'll come to me in a minute. There were no flights, basically. Yeah. I tell you when it was. It was when there was a terrorism threat, and all British people had to travel with a clear plastic bag with their belongings in it. Do you remember that?
I remember that. Yeah.
That was so. There were flights. There was no flights. There was all sorts of shit going on, and I remember the first thing before I knew that my father had died. I said to Taj, "Oh, what a journey, man! We just had to be searched, and we had to travel like this, and they all thought we were criminals, and you know." And he looked at me and he said, "Welcome to my world, man."
Mm.
You know, and then 5 minutes later, this other thing happened.
Oh,
so he said to me, "Do you want me to do the show?" This was after I tried to get home and realized I couldn't. I said, "No, I've got to stay here." I said, "My dad would want me to play, you know." "You're being paid well?" "Yes." I mean, he said, "Well, do the gig." You know what I mean? That's how your dad would be, wouldn't it? It's like, it's a job. Go and do your job, you know. So I did the gig. And his guys were just wonderful to everybody. And Ed, and it was an extraordinary experience. I sort of don't really remember that much about any of it because I don't know where my head was. But it was a storming gig. They loved it. We were in a marquee. It was a few thousand people. And it was jumping and did the gig. Got back to the hotel, sort of didn't sleep, I suppose, and ended up on a plane. I don't know. It's all a bit surreal, but Taj was wonderful. Surreal. And his guys were just so nice to me and so good. They'd have done anything for me.
Just the fact that you could go on and even do that. I mean, it's just astonishing, you know, and astonishing. And it shows, I think, in so many ways, what it is to be a musician in terms of, like,
yeah,
you have to put other things aside sometimes and do the job and just do it for whatever it takes and for whatever.
I think that's the same with any job, isn't it? You don't bring your home to work, you know. You don't bring your, if you've just had a row with your wife, you don't bring that to work or onto the stage, and if you try not to. And that day, yeah, I mean, it was an odd one. It was very surreal because I was also, you know, my father was a soldier in the Second World War, and there I am in Germany entertaining Germans on the day he died. You know, there was a strange irony going on there. It was a very strange thing, and there was nothing I could do. I couldn't get home. I'd been through that panic of an hour or whatever it was. I've got to get home. I've got to get home to my mum, and you know, but I couldn't. So what do I do? What am I going to do? Well, I'll do the gig. That's why I'm here.
Yeah. And so you did.
And I know, as I say, my dad would have said, "Well, don't not do the gig. You won't get paid." You know?
Yeah.
That's what he'd have said. So.
Astonishing. So, I mean, wow. I mean, I just think that's incredible that it's just.
And Taj was lovely. You know, Taj was delightful.
And it just shows that, I think, that just the wonderful kind of breadth of your life, that here's somebody who you have been, you know, you have listened to, bought his records, and then there he is helping you through that, the worst thing we can all kind of go through, really.
Yeah.
This legend and this amazing performer that's just there being a decent human. Shows just how, what a strange world we live in when, you know, these kind of paths cross and these things happen. So
we were working together. We're a team. When we're together, whoever's on that show that night, we're together, you know. I heard the guys from Delamitri being interviewed on the radio yesterday, and they were talking about when they opened for the Rolling Stones, and that night, you know, they were part of the Rolling Stones in their dressing room and just part of the show. And that's the same with any show, you know. A show is, whoever's there that night, you're working together. We're a team. So I couldn't do the gig. So Taj was prepared to do the gig for me.
But he was just going to step in and help a brother. Yeah, well, it's one of the things, I think, why anybody who kind of gets into music, and they can, again, there's this kind of synergy thing. Like, I think we all know, like, often when you're hanging around, say, festivals or with other musicians, it's very easy and very quick to form very nice relationships because you're all in the same situation. You're all the very, very similar personality types. And this is just, for me, it's another nice example of where, right, you know, just people pull together to get the show, and it's lovely.
Yeah.
I'm afraid
we've got to stop, haven't we?
We've really overgone, but I just think there's so much to say, and we'll talk about the guitar business later on.
It's amazing. I mean, you know, this is, it's wonderful. Thank you for doing this. It's brilliant. It's brilliant.
It's a pleasure. And I'm so glad we could do this. And so what we're going to do is we just have some set questions we ask everybody.
Oh, go.
And then what we'll do is we'll say goodbye. And it's really nice. So do you want to, I'll do a couple of questions from the set questions. So one of the questions is like, how would you explain what you do to a 5-year-old?
Well, I have done, because I did Zingzillas, didn't I?
Yeah.
I did children's TV. How would I explain it to a 5-year-old? I play guitar and sing.
There we go. I mean, that's it. Brilliant. Easy. Yeah, that's it. To the point. And then it's a really obvious question, but I think it's very revealing when we do these podcasts, which is that if you could go back in time and give yourself advice, what would it be? Your younger self advice.
My younger self advice, maybe take a few more of the opportunities. Don't, you know, they don't come twice.
Mm.
Take it.
Wow, I wonder what I missed out on. You seem to have achieved so much.
You've done it all.
But I think that I do realize in life now, I see it like when something, yeah, it's very easy with younger people to do that. I don't need to worry about that. I'll do something else. I just think, take the opportunity that's put in front of you. Don't not take it. Mm. Definitely don't not take it. There's a few things I wish I'd done that I haven't done and didn't do, which don't come again. It's not to do with being older and not being, I could do them, but that offer doesn't come again.
Mm. Can you say what or not?
Really good record deal.
All right.
Really good record deal that I was offered when King Guitar came out. By an American label that involved doing 200-300 shows a year for a couple of years around America.
Right, so it was like a big management deal where they're going to get you out there and get your name out there and just pound the streets,
big,
as it were.
Big stuff. Wow. Good one, which I turned down because I didn't want to commit myself to that.
Yeah.
Oh, there's another great story which I haven't told you, but I can't. That's too late. I didn't tell you that I nearly became. I nearly became the musical director of Doctor Hook in 1985.
Wow, as you do.
It's a long story, and it fell apart. But yeah.
Doctor Hook, another great band. I mean,
I became in Nashville when I was there in '85. I became friends with Ray Sawyer. Yeah. The singer with the patch, yeah. and Ray was coming to Europe to form a Doctor Hook band, and he asked me to put the band together.
So that's another one. And then, do you know what? I remember about 2.5 hours ago when this started, there was a Stevie Ray Vaughan thing I want to talk about. We have run out of time, but there's a really famous picture of Stevie Ray Vaughan playing a resonator,
which
guitar.
My brother took, Alan. Yes,
your brother took it. Was that the album cover?
Yeah, it was the Instep album cover.
So the story goes, your brother Alan's taking the picture of Steve Ray Vaughan for the album, and he had a resonator guitar in the room, and you said, oh, my brother plays a resonator, and he picked up the resonator just to like, oh yeah, this resonator, and then your brother snapped the picture and that became the album cover. It was like an outpower shot, and that was you.
Pretty much, they sort of talking about brothers, because Alan, my brother Alan, very family bound and brothers, and Stevie and his brother, so there was a thing about brothers, and my brother plays the national guitar, and Stevie picked his one up and said this was Blind Boy Fuller's, which we know isn't true, but Stevie liked that story. And Alan said, what do you do? And they were talking about me and what I play and that kind of thing. And Alan said, what do you play on it? And Stevie bent down to tune it, and that's the picture.
That's the album cover, and that was from, yeah. I mean, it's just, you've done it all. So unfortunately, and I am going to have to tear myself away from this conversation, we are going to stop this, but thank you for taking the time to tell us about your kind of amazing career and your amazing like relationship to music. And I think great tale that's going to resonate, no pun intended, with so many players and musicians out there.
Well, thank you for doing it, because
it's
for me, it's been amazing, because it's not often that you get in anyone's life, it's not often you get to actually talk about those things and piece it all together. And as I said, the older I get, and I'm not trying to make this go on, but the older I get, the more interested in the absolute truth I am, and the bullshit and what was cool and what sounded good at the time. You know, what records you like? Oh, Robert Johnson, man, you know, like that doesn't matter now. What matters is the truth. And it's very important that truth gets documented.
Exactly, and as we've talked about before, when we're setting up this podcast, you know, we're just trying to create a place where we can talk to people who really have lived music and just make a place where these stories can be told, and we just hope that it helps other musicians figure out for themselves what to do and what not to do, and to make a place where people can learn and hopefully be entertained and hear some great stories as well. I love talking to you guys.
I love what you guys do.
Oh, that's
and
kind.
The fact that what the tradition you're carrying forward. And the way that you know,
and it's so nice.
Became aware of it as soon as you started doing it.
There's a whole world of in normal times we're in the pandemic now, but there's a whole world of times where we go around gigging all over the place, and we're always seeing your posters in the same venues, these little art center venues and places, and it's just nice to be able to talk to you naturally.
Yeah, yeah. Well, likewise.
Flesh on the bones, of course, and you've been a big help in terms of, you know, just teaching me about resonators and the history, and it's just I can't thank you enough. So Jack, is there anything else you'd like to add to the end of this interview, any questions or anything before we bring it to a close?
There's a couple other questions that we ask all of our guests.
Do you know what, Jack, I didn't write them down before this interview. One of them is Michael Messer. Everybody in the world wants to know the answer to this. How do you have your tea?
How do I have my tea? What English tea, you mean?
Well, this is fascinating. Who knows?
I make real tea, not with a tea bag.
Loose leaf
tea, proper tea.
Magic mushrooms in there?
Not anymore. But I make real tea.
Yep.
Organic.
Organic. Tea.
Yeah,
nice.
I don't drink milk anymore, so I use a nice organic soy milk.
Oh, lovely.
And I make a nice strong, what you would call builder's tea. Oof. And I make, that's what I drink for tea. But
that's
also
the poshest builder's tea ever. Loose leaf, soy
milk. Poshest builder's tea ever, yes. But I do like real tea. I've gone off tea bags.
Michael Messer, I just want to say thank you very much. This has been
genuinely,
for me, a thrill and a wonderful thing to hear. And I've really taken the time to share. And
for me too.
I'm looking
thank
forward
you.
To putting
no, both
this
of
out.
You, Jack and Martin, thank you.
No, thank you for talking to us. It's been a real pleasure.
No, yeah. It's been an absolute pleasure.
So there we go. I mean, this was a very long interview, but what did you think of that, Jack? Was there anything of interest there to you?
Yeah, well, just great to know his story, isn't it? And all the things I think he's managed to accomplish, a lot of things in his kind of very all-encompassing careers of not just playing, but producing and, well, creating instruments and all things like that, really.
Yeah, he's a fascinating guy. I mean, obviously just an incredible personality, and he's you know, done it his life, and it's just amazing. So I'm really glad we could share that. So thank you very much for listening, everybody, and we'll say goodbye now.
Yeah, and again, if you want to find him online, it's Michael Messer, so check him out there. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to The Washboard Resonators Present.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate, and leave a comment.
And to support our band, please sign up to the mailing list. You'll find the link in the show notes and on the website.